for everybody who's listening. Well, you have to be listening, otherwise you couldn't hear this. This is Rick Wakeman, and you're listening to the 9-8 Podcast.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the 9-8 Podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg, and this week, boy, do we have a guest for you, prog rock keyboard maestro Rick Wakeman. In this chat, we cover his new record, The Red Planet, performing live, using digital instruments, his charity work, and a whole bunch more. Enjoy. Rick Wakeman, welcome to the 9-8 Podcast.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, so let's start with the genesis for the new record, the Red Planet. What was it that piqued your interest in Mars enough to write an album about it?
Well, I knew a little bit about Mars because I'm sort of have many astronaut friends and many friends at NASA, and but I suppose the real thing about Mars came about a few years ago when I was talking with Brian May. And who introduced me to Stephen Hawkins, Professor Stephen Hawkins, and also to a guy called Garrick Israelian, who is the guy who was part of the team that proved and discovered black holes. I mean, they're all rocket scientists. I mean, I don't understand a word they say, but it's they're lovely guys, obviously. And Brian is an astrophysicist. And he told me about this festival called Starmus. And Starmus is a festival which has lots of astronauts and people involved in space and scientists who do various lectures at this festival. And then on the very last day, they have a massive concert. And Brian obviously did the first year, very successful. And they've had many people since. And he said, you should get involved because he said, you've done albums about space. I know you love space. And he said, you should come and do one. So I did the 2017 in Tenerife. And I did the show, and Brian came and played with me in the band, which was great. And I really loved it. And that was where I met for the first time Professor Stephen Hawkins. And I thought, I'll go to one of his lectures. That'll be interesting. So I went to this lecture, which lasted about 2 hours, and I can honestly tell you that I did not understand one word, nothing. And that all these wonderful sort of diagrams and things on the film that they showed, that, again, didn't make any sense to me. But it was riveting. I loved it. It was just fantastic. I sat there as if I understood everything, although I didn't. And I went to a couple of other different lectures, and then through Garrick, I was lucky enough to attend one of the last lectures that Alexei Leonov did, who was the first Russian to walk in space, and I got to know him. And it was great because I watched that lecture and didn't understand a word he said either. But it was just so fascinating, these people. And then I got to know them and a lot of the astronauts as well afterwards, and getting them to explain some things in layman's terms for me was just fascinating. And then in 2019, we did the 50th anniversary of the moon landings, of Man on the Moon, which we did the concert in Zurich with, there was myself, Hans Zimmer, Steve Vai, Brian May, of course, a huge orchestra and choir. It was astonishing. And the interesting thing was, at the very end, with the orchestra, choir, and all the people that I've just mentioned, we played We Are the Champions, and on the stage walked all the surviving astronauts who'd walked on the moon. Now, I've been really lucky in my life. I've played some massive auditoriums, and I've heard roars from audiences that are just break all decibel levels. I have never heard a roar like the one in Zurich when these surviving astronauts walked on to the stage. They drowned us out. Now, to drown out Brian May, Steve Vai, myself, Hans Zimmer, orchestra, choir, and a kitchen sink of musicians was quite astonishing. But you literally couldn't hear what we were doing. It was amazing. And it was shortly before that, I was sitting having a meal with Garrick in London. He flew to London, and he was saying, a load of people have been asking you to make another instrumental prog record. Why haven't you done it? And I said, well, the interesting thing is, Garrick, is I can't just write music and then give it a title and go, oh, that's what this is. I said, I need to have a subject that really inspires me, that gets inside of me, that I go, this, I've got to do this. And he went, oh, okay, well, I'm sure it will come. And I went, yeah, okay. And then he said, oh, by the way, 2021. And I said, yeah. He said, another anniversary. And I said, what's that all? He said, of the first mission to Mars. He said, there have been over 50 now. The first mission went to Mars. In fact, it was a Russian that the first went there. And I said, mission to 50th anniversary, Mars. I said, Mars is a fascinating planet. And he said, oh, he said, we know. He said, I mean, it's pretty much well established and believed now that 2 million years ago, Mars was the closest thing to Earth now. Okay, the atmosphere was different. It didn't have anywhere near as much oxygen. So, but it did have oceans and rivers and heaven knows what else. And you start thinking, this is fantastic. And then I think it was Garrick who said to me, you know, maybe David Bowie was right. Maybe there is life on Mars, or was life on Mars. And I said, you've just given me an inspirational subject that I know I can write to. And he said, oh, great. So I came back to my home, and I contacted some of my friends at NASA. Also, Garrick contacted some people for me. And apart from the amazing amount of photos and information on Mars that's on the internet, they sent me stuff that's not in the public domain to look at. And basically, cut a long story short, I just printed out about 300 photos of different areas of Mars, reading notes about all the areas, reading notes about it all. And then it was quite easy, because what I did then, I surrounded the piano with the photos. And bits and pieces that I'd read about, and had a lot of manuscript paper there, and just started writing, and it just started to flow and come very easy, because when you look at the pictures and read things about it, it's musically incredibly inspiring. So I did that for about over a period of about 3 to 4 months to try and collect it. The music that I was happy with, and started putting it together as actual pieces. Then discussing it with my co-producer, Eric Jordan, about the sounds and the instruments that we wanted to use. And we decided that we wanted to make it like a 21st century, 1970s prog record. So we wanted to have a lot of the great sounds from the 70s, but using all the technology that we have today. Which is exactly what we did, and I picked three musicians that I knew would understand what I wanted, because that's important. That's something that I learned from David Bowie. David Bowie said to me, well, when we were doing the Hunky Dory album, he said, always pick musicians that you know understand what you're trying to achieve. He said, if you do that, then you'll get the result you want. He said, it's no good getting musicians, however good they are, if you don't think they understand what you're trying to achieve. So I picked Lee Pomeroy, who I rate as the, and many other people do as well, as the finest bass player that there is around at the moment anywhere. Ash Sohn, who is a phenomenal drummer, and I knew would understand what I was wanted to do. And Dave Colquhoun, who Brian May rates as one of the best guitarists that there is around, who is very musical and very technically brilliant as well. So put those two together and you've got a great combination. And it was then in the studio, and over a period of about 2 months, we put the album together. And I have to say, when we finally finished it, and it was all mixed, I normally listen and want to make a lot of changes. And I listened, and Eric Jordan, my engineer, co-producer, said, anything you want to change? And I went, nothing. I said, I've never had an album quite like this since The Six Wives, where I can say, that's it, thank you, don't want to change a single thing. So that next stage, I suppose, was the album cover, because thanks to the resurgence of vinyl, which is fantastic, of course, thanks to that, we can put a cover together where you can actually have writing on it that people can read. And so we decided to take as much care over the cover as we used to do back in the 70s. Back in the 70s, the cover was almost equally as important as to what went on the vinyl, because it was your introduction to what people were going to hear, which is why with Yes, we were so lucky to find the wonderful Roger Dean for his covers, because if ever there was a match made in heaven, it was there. So I spoke to Martin Cook, who's a designer I really like, along with the executive producer of the album, Rob Ayling. And I said, well, look, there's certain obvious things. Mars is going to have to be included on the front for obvious reasons. That's important. And I said, it would be nice to have a few different things. And I said, I don't want my photo on the front. And they said, well, why not have an astronaut on the front? I said, oh, that would be fun. So we put a spaceman on the front, and I said, it'd be great if he was playing an instrument. So that we put in a Mini Moog, which was great. We loved that. And then I said, look at all these buttons. It'd be great to put things on the buttons. To see, like, we put David Bowie's sign on and a few other bits and pieces. And then it was Rob, the executive producer, who said, do you fancy a pop-up? And I said, well, like pop-up books. And he said, yeah, it's opening up and you get a pop-up. I said, I love it. So we had some mock-ups done until we got it as we really liked it. The cover was born, and we wanted to get as much information as possible. In fact, on the repressings, we're putting even more information on, because a lot of people have said they wanted more information about keyboards used and how things were done. So there's quite a lot of extra stuff going on the next repressing.
Oh, that's fantastic. I've had a chance to listen to the record, and congratulations, by the way. It is a fantastic
that's
record.
That's very, very kind. The check I sent you cleared then, did it? Yeah,
okay. But one thing I was going to say is the song The North Plain, and when I was listening to it, it definitely brought forth visions of a big, massive, wide open space out in front of me. So when you were writing the music and you had these sort of manuscripts and notes about it, did you start with a title in mind and think, right, this is going to lead, or did you have the music first and then the title come later?
There were certain areas of Mars that really attracted me, certainly picture-wise. The North Plain, of course, which is up there, there are two poles. It's the North Pole. There's a North Pole and a South Pole. And I looked at them both because they were both incredibly musical to write to. But the North Plain, with its vast space, and it has rain, although the interesting thing is it doesn't rain as we know it. It rains dry ice, the equivalent of dry ice. And I thought, that's fantastic, because if ever there was anything associated with 1970s prog rock, it was dry ice. So it just had to be that. And instead of calling it the North Pole, because I wasn't sure at the time whether I was going to do a South Pole as well, I called it the North Plain, which is another a name for the wider area of that part of Mars.
Yeah, it's a really lovely track. I really liked that one. You mentioned David Bowie there, and you've been quoted in past interviews that David Bowie told you to always write on piano, because if it sounds good on piano, it can only get better when you add layers to it. So you started writing this album on the piano. How did you choose what other synth parts to replace or augment the piano?
Interestingly enough, on the album there is very little piano. There is some piano, but there's very little piano. Basically, while I was writing it and putting the music down, I was also in another pad making notes of sounds that I thought would be suitable for different parts. And I also spent some time going back listening to earlier records of mine from the 70s, and not always the instrumental albums. They included albums like No Earthly Connection, and listening to sounds and things, and then and every now and then one would jump out and go, do you know what, I really like that, so why did I never use that again? Or use it in a different way. I mean, one of the things was The Earthly Connection that stuck out to me was the use of the mellotron flutes, not as a chordal kind of thing or a vamping kind of thing, but as playing a really nice theme. And I really liked that. And there was a couple of pieces that I'd been working on, and one I was wondering what to play the theme on, and it was just so blatantly obvious to do it on the flutes, which is what I did. And it's so all the way through the writing, I was making notes. And I suppose by the time we started in the studio, I was 75% of knowing what sounds I wanted to use or how to create them. But the other thing we do, which I do with my engineer, Eric, is we don't use any sounds that are just the basic sounds that you can get on an instrument or on a piece of software. We edit so many things together to create the sounds that we want to create. So I often get people say to me, oh, we've got a cool Croce and we can't find that sound that you seem to be using. And I go, well, no, you won't, because we created it ourselves. So it's that, which is how you sort of create, you know, individuality wherever the best you can. So there was a lot of intense preparation that went on before the album. Well, in fact, right the way through to when it was finally finished, and I can't remember ever doing an album which has absorbed me so much for so many years. It's it really has, and I'm pleased with the writing. The other thing that I wanted to get in, which was important to me, was one of the things that I loved about the early prog rock thing was melodies. There were always melodies, great melodies that you could recognize and latch onto. Not just great sounds, not just great solos, and not just great playing. So I wanted to make sure that every piece had some great melodies, also some good riffs, some sounds from the 70s, and some sounds from the 21st century. So it was really a melting pot of so many things.
Yeah, you mentioned there with the vast availability of the synths that are available to you these days. I mean, yeah. When you're using the synth plugins, particularly of the older sounds in the Hammond organs and that sort of thing, I mean, those are game changers when you're performing live, because you don't have to lug around massive analog bits of equipment. When you're in the studio, though, do you prefer to use those analog instruments, or do you use the plugins that are available to kind of mimic those sounds?
It depends on the project. With this project, I wanted to use the plugins and the soft synths and those that are on hardware on certain keyboards straight away. And the reason for that is the best way I can describe it is, if you've got a band and you're playing away and the organ, let's just make this up and say, so I've got a Hammond organ sound that I really like, and you play that Hammond in many places through this particular piece. But then when you listen back, for some unknown reason, in certain areas, it might not quite have the effect or the power that you wanted it to have. But you can't understand why, because it's the same sound that you used at the beginning or somewhere else. The reason often is because what else is playing is clouding the issue. For example, one of the biggest clouds that you get with Hammonds and another instrument is the bass, because there's great low end on the Hammonds, and if you've got a bass playing, they can block each other out. So one of the things that you can do with the sausage, which we work pretty hard on, when you get to those areas, we then re-edit the Hammond so that you still got that powerful sound that you want, but also you can hear the bass lines, that everything can come through, and you can hear every note that the bass is playing in the instrument. And that's really important for a record like this, that you don't have to fight to hear something. You can actually hear what people are doing. So that's why, for this particular project, I wanted to have original sounds, but using the modern technology in order to create the tracks to sound as I wanted to. So if somebody wanted to listen to all the bass, or listen to all the guitar, or listen to certain things on the drums, it wasn't all blocked out. And the same with the keyboards. You can actually identify what each layer is.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that when we were going through this record on the last episode, we particularly noted that, you know, the great melodies that were on this record and the very sort of very distinct orchestration as well. I've known other records where you have the keyboards and you have an orchestra and you have a choir, and then sometimes you either get, you know, the orchestra drowns out the keyboards or the keyboards drown out the choir. So it was very nice to hear all of those elements in sort of synchronicity like that.
Yeah, it was nice to be able to do that. I mean, I was able to do things, just as you said there, that I couldn't have done back in the 1970s. You just couldn't do that. So it was great to be able to, shall we say, cover every aspect I wanted to. And you're quite right, instruments, they can drown each other out. And certainly sometimes when you've got orchestra, choir, keyboards, bad, it just becomes... and there's nothing wrong with it, but it just becomes one giant sound. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. But this album wasn't ever intended to be a giant sound.
Oh, that's fantastic. This is your 18th studio album. I've heard other artists talk about the struggle to not repeat themselves musically as their career progresses. During the writing process, did you ever come up with something and go, actually, no, I've done that before, and kind of get rid of it, toss it away?
Occasionally what can happen, because, you know, when you consider you've only got 12 notes to play with initially, what can happen is you can be playing a melody and suddenly it will go into something that you've done and you go, oh, crikey, that's and you sort of spot it. So you stop and sort of it's then pretty easy to work out why you've gone down that route. And then the best thing to do in that situation is you leave it, walk away and come back at another time. And maybe rethink what's underneath and redo it. Yeah, it's bound to happen. I mean, I've done so many albums over the years. I mean, it does happen. And I mean, there's a great story about my sort of Eastern European hero, Sergei Prokofiev, who was always working on four or five things at the same time in his music area with the charts. And there was, the story goes that when he finished two of the pieces, he realized that two of the orchestral pages repeated themselves in two other pieces. And they fitted perfectly. So that was a swift rewrite. It happens a lot, and I'm sure it will continue to happen.
Actually, now that you mentioned that, I'm reminded of a story, wasn't it, with two of your albums? I think it might have been Sea Airs and Night Airs or something, where two songs inadvertently ended up on the wrong record and they had to, it was a quick title swap somewhere. I think it was on your, mentioned on your website.
I think you're right. I think there was a sort of a weird pressing where there was in the days of vinyl, where one side got printed and the other side was printed from another album and things. I mean, that's pretty common to happen as well. It was rectified. I mean, the weirdest one I ever had was, and it's very collectible if you can find it. I did an album donkeys years ago called The Family Album, and when I got the first pressings through, I had a quick play. Yeah, that's all right. That's fine. Just stick on the first side. And then somebody wrote, we'd only shipped out a couple of thousand, and somebody in the UK, somebody wrote and said, really like the album, but, and this is back in the 80s, why is it a story on the side two, and it's just piano on side one? And I thought, what's that all about? So I went and got the record. It's only been released about a week, so it was only out in the shops, about 2,000 copies or something. And I put it on, and side one was fine, and I put on side two, and there was piano that started it off, and I thought, I don't remember playing that, and that's not really a very good playing. And just as I was sitting back going, I don't think this is me, there was a voice went, Rupert Bear walked into the forest. Rupert Bear was looking for his friends to play with. And I've got a whole side of Rupert the Bear. Kiddie story. So we tried to recall the 2,000 albums that were out. It had all gone pear-shaped at the pressing plant. And we got back, I think, about 1,000. And 1,000 never came back because we said we'll replace them. And we never replaced them. And they became incredibly collectible. I've still got my copy here somewhere. But, these things happen.
Some poor bloke who's buying Rupert the Bear for his kid. You know, the first half of the record is Rupert the Bear, and the second half is, you know, some.
Yeah, that's some, true. Yeah, yep. there'll be a few very bewildered kids. That's true.
Yeah, let's say money and logistics were of no concern, and good. Wouldn't we all like that to be the case in this world at this time? Ideally, how would you like this album to be presented live?
Well, we're going to do it live, actually. We're doing it at the Starmus Festival in Armenia next year. I cannot do it just with myself and the lads that I used on the record. It can't be done as a four-piece because of the amount of keyboards and the... It just can't be done. So what I will do is I will add at least two more musicians, one of which would be my son, Adam, who will come, because he plays keyboards and guitars. He plays for Ozzy Osbourne and Sabbath, has done for donkey's years. But he's a great player and a great guitar player too. So he will come in and have specific parts and things for him to play. And I probably will get in one other guitarist, keyboard player, instrumentalist, who can finish. So as the band, we will do the major things. But if there's parts you go, hey, listen, how do we do that? I can't play that and that at the same time. You can't do that and that at the same time. So we will give it to somebody else because I want it to be presented as best as humanly possible, obviously. So that's what we're aiming for Armenia. And then it would be great. I would love to take it on tour, but that will all depend on how well the record does, I suppose.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, my wife and I were lucky to attend both of your shows just over a year ago, to the day almost, at the Royal Festival Hall for both Journey to the Centre of the Earth shows. And I know your son Adam was there playing some keyboards and stuff as well. Looking back on those shows now, how did they go from your perspective?
I tell you, I loved it. It was my birthday present to myself. Because it was so expensive to do. And we knew that if we sold out both shows, I would break even. So that's exactly what happened. And I got some friends and that involved. It was just a wonderful night. I can't tell you the wonderful atmosphere backstage and the smiles on everybody's faces, and that including the orchestra and choir and all the guys in the band and great friends who came and sang, like Alfie Bow and that, who came to do for me. It was just wonderful. The interesting thing was the first night, the Saturday, was perhaps, shall we say, a little bit more safe, in as much as that it was very much what we call eyes down, look in, to make sure we got it right. The second night was, shall we say, in a much looser, where everybody just, you know, went up another, notched up another gear. Because one of the hardest things with Journey is the new version is one long piece, and the conductor alone has 68 cues to give to different people, and if you miss one or lose your place, you can't stop. You just can't afford for that to happen. It really is a mammoth task to do. And the second night, I think I would have loved to have filmed and recorded it, but we couldn't afford to do it. We would have loved to have done that, because that would have been, for me, a great lasting memory of Journey.
Oh, it would have been. If I remember correctly, I think the second night was the same night that England won the Cricket World Cup as well.
It was. It was hilarious, because it went down to the famous last, you know, the golden
the super
ball.
Over.
Super over, and the golden ball was there. And the audience were there, and so we were actually a few minutes late coming on so that we could give the result.
Yeah, I remember actually, because I was the lone Australian several rows back actually booing because I wanted the Kiwis to win. And then, of course, you know, the English got over the line and beat them.
Yeah, I know. Right, ironically, we know that there was at least six Kiwis in that night because we pretty much know where people came from. It just added to the celebration, really.
Absolutely. You are regarded as one of the icons in progressive rock music, a noted inspiration to many of the new generation in prog music. How do you view the music coming out of those newer bands rising up through the ranks?
Well, there's some good stuff. But, I mean, the interesting thing is that prog rock has, you know, it's spread out in many different ways, in the same way that rock and roll did when it first was all around with like the likes of Bill Haley and Little Richard and all those kind of people. It's spread to become, you've got your metal, you've got your prog rock, you've got some folk rock, you've got so many different kinds of rock music, and prog rock has done the same. I mean, when you've got the bands from the 70s and the people who play like the likes of Yes, General John, and myself, and a few others, and then you sort of come into the 80s and 90s and even the 2000s, and you look at the different kinds of what Dream Theater have done, which is they've created their own form of prog rock, which is great. You've got bands like Miles Volta. You've got other bands like Carnatica. And there's just loads of them now. And they're all good because they're all musicians who play from the head and the heart and do what they want. They're not ruled by how much money can we make. They're ruled by, I want to make this music. And that's what's really great about prog rock. It's a freedom for musicians, if they want to make music with their head and their heart.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen there are videos on YouTube and from instructional DVDs of Jordan Rudess sort of going through the process of how he would layer keyboard sounds on the Kurzweil or his Korg Kronos or something like that. I imagine that you and him have probably maybe spoken about that at some point, and the way that both of you approach that.
I think it's very good what Jordan does. I know Jordan very well. He's a great, great player, great guy, and his online video stuff that he does is really, really good. And he does it really, really well. I am not that good at doing that kind of thing, which is why I steer clear of it. It's like when people ask me, well, where do your ideas come from? And the simple answer is, I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I can sit down and write you a piece of music now. It won't be inspirational, but it'll be based on the knowledge that I know how to write music. But then occasionally something will start to happen. And you'll go, hold on a minute, this is special. And that's when the inspiration arrives. Where that comes from, I really don't know. On the actual technical side of things of layering how I do it, I think everybody has their own way of doing things. I mean, my way of doing things is different from Jordan's. And the same way that Jordan's would have been different from Keith Emerson's or John Law or whoever, really. It's a very individualistic thing, prog rock. And I think the thing to do is, if you find a way that works for you and is exciting and you get the end result you want, then you've found what you're looking for. I mean, one of the things with the Red Planet for me was I wanted to be comfortable with how the music sounded. I didn't want it to sound techno 21st century. That wasn't what I was aiming to do. And I think that's where Jordan's been clever as well, because he's stuck to that Dream Theater style, which works so well. It works well for him.
Absolutely. One last question. Interviewers like me always want to talk to you about your music or some of the people you've played with or your work in comedy. But what's one topic that you'd like to talk about that no one's ever asked you about before?
Oh, crikey, that's a really good question. The one topic that nobody's ever asked for, probably, I mean, I get asked about it a little bit now, but probably would be the organisations that I belong to, which some people might raise their eyebrows a little bit. I mean, I'm a member of the Grand Order of Water Rats, which you can find all about them online, which is the oldest entertainment order in the world, and has had some phenomenal people involved with it over the years, including Laurel and Hardy and Charlie Chaplin and a few others. I also am a Knight Templar, of which there are not many of us, which was an order I joined and studied after becoming a Freemason. Freemasonry, I occasionally get asked about. People think it's this weird secret society with funny handshakes and bearing different parts of your body. The truth of the matter is Freemasonry is one of the biggest fundraisers for charity in the world. It's in the UK alone, it's second only to the lottery. And the amount of good work and things that it does is just tremendous. And we just have a lot of fun. Yes, we do have ceremonies, but if you like stories, which I do, the ceremonies are all storytelling. And they're great, and I love that kind of thing. And I love the fact of the fantastic amount of good work that it does. The mistake I think that Freemasonry sometimes makes is it keeps very quiet. It doesn't tell people the great work that it does. I am the patron of one part of Freemasonry that supplies all sorts of software, computers and equipment to children's hospices around the UK, about 60 of them, which includes incredible features that kids who otherwise couldn't communicate can communicate, even if they only have a movement in their eyelid, the same as Stephen Hawking has. They can paint pictures, they can make music, they can do all sorts of things, they can communicate in a way they've never been able to before. And we supply all of these places. It costs millions. And we also send in people to train the people in there, upgrade and all that kind of thing. But nobody knows. And except obviously the hospice is concerned, the people. And that's just one tiny example of the great work that they do. During the pandemic, I know that millions have been spent that they've raised to help the NHS and to help people who are in trouble and suffering around. And I suppose it does annoy me sometimes when people, they know that I'm a Freemason, I have quite a high rank, and they say, oh, it's that secret society, you know, you just all dress up silly and do thing, and it gets right up my nose, and I go, what do you know about it? What do we do? And they say, well, oh, no, you just, you know, and I said, you know, it's a massive charity. It's fantastic. And you start telling people, they go, oh, well, we didn't know that. And the truth of the matter is, it's not their fault for not knowing. It's our fault for not telling people. The same way with I'm a member of the Worshipful Company of Glovers, which is the Worshipful Companies in London, are really important. And that, again, the massive amount of charity work. I mean, already in the pandemic, we've supplied millions of pairs of gloves to the NHS and to hospitals and to various places. We do bursaries for students, for kids in all kinds of different things. And there are all these great charities. And a lot of people knock these great societies. And it's, as I say, it is ignorance, but it's ignorance because they're not told about it. So if I ever get on my high horse about anything, it is that, because I'm very proud to be a water runner. I'm proud to be a member of the Worshipful Company of Glovers, I'm proud to be a freeman of the City of London. I'm proud to be a Freemason. I'm proud to be a Knight Templar, not because it's got any status, so I don't go around telling anybody, although I've just told you. It's because of the fantastic work they do. And you know, I can recommend to anybody, if you want to get involved with something a little bit different, but doing a lot of good, then have a look at some of these organisations, because they might be very surprised.
Absolutely, I think part of it there is, and I don't want to keep you too much longer to talk about this, but I think part of it as well is like it's sort of got this idea of like an inverted, like in quotes, old money sort of idea, and that it's sort of a high society sort of thing, and maybe that's why people don't necessarily know too much about it.
Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, you can have anybody join. I mean, in Masonic lodges, you can have anybody from a surgeon to a man who's a refuse collector. To, you know, you can have all sorts of people on board, and also colour and creed and religion plays no part at all. I mean, I've had people say to me, "Oh, well, there's no Jews." I said, yes, there are. There's loads of Jews. I mean, the lodge that I'm in, Chelsea Lodge, there's probably more Jewish people than there are anybody else. You know, you get all this. We've got Hindus, Arabs, we've got Muslims, you name it, they're in. We've got all different colours. It makes no difference to us whatsoever. But we don't see why we have to go, you know, we shouldn't have to go around and say, oh, we allow everybody in of race, colour or creed. The fact is, we do, but we don't have to go around telling everybody. You know, it should be something that's understood, that we are multiracial, multicultural and multi-religion.
Yeah, absolutely. And wouldn't it be nice if we had a bit more of that going on in this world at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I do get a bit annoyed sometimes when everybody feels they have to tell somebody that, oh, this is not a racial club or a racial thing. You know, why do you have to tell anybody? If you're not, it should be blatantly obvious. You know, I think sometimes I'd like to get back to, I'll call almost normality. I mean, I'm 71. I mean, when I was at school, we had all sorts of people in the class of different countries, of different religions, different colours. But that never thought about that. We just knew somebody by their name. And that was it. You know, it suddenly all becomes pushed to the forefront of your heritage. And I find that, I find it sad. Because you should have, the same. We're all exactly the same. We all have different skills. We all have different problems. We all have different difficulties. We should be there to help each other, not help each other just because we're a different colour or a different race or a different. I find that phenomenal. I mean, I like people. I've got, I'm sure the same as you, all kinds of friends, but I don't refer to one as a black friend or as a yellow friend if they're trying. I don't do. It's ridiculous. So I get on my high horse a bit about all of that. I think that you know, we have potential to have a wonderful world, and I think that it's being spoilt mainly by humans.
Yeah, absolutely. Could not agree with you more on that. I know one of the places that you can you've spoken about the Grand Order of the Water Rats is in your books. I know there's been a third book of yours in the pipeline happening for some time now. How's that coming along?
It's been held up a little bit because I've been so busy on the music side of things, but I will get back to it, and it will be. Yeah, it's coming along. I don't know where the stories keep appearing from, but they do. And there'll be a few more rat stories in there. There'll be probably a few Masonic stories. It's a good chance to put the record straight in a few things as of what we've just been talking about with things like Freemasonry and whatever. Because, I mean, we do have a laugh. It has to be said. We do have a laugh.
I think we need more humour in the world these days, especially in a time like this.
Oh, we really could do with it. But humour's been curtailed so much because of political correctness. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, something is either funny or it's not funny. It's either offensive or it's not offensive. I don't see why we have to analyse everything that anybody says, unless, of course, it is offensive, unless, of course, it's wrong. In which case, that is wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I think that about wraps it up here on the 9-8 podcast. Rick Wegman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks you very much indeed. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks, Alex.
So that about wraps it up for this week on the 9-8 podcast. If you'd like to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at the 9-8podcast.fireside.fm/IV10. You can find us on Twitter at 98FM. And if you'd like to, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/the98podcast. Until next week, my name is Alex Hogg. Stay safe, stay home, and we'll see you all next time.
The 9-8 interview.